Welcome to Arguendo, the Veterans Law Podcast with Amy and Amy, the show that focuses on oral arguments and trends at the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims
and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and sometimes, maybe even today, the Supreme Court. We're your hosts. I'm Amy Odom.
And I'm Amy Kritkowski.
The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session.
And this podcast is going to dive into two oral arguments, both from the Veterans Court, and maybe one or two from the Supreme Court.
We'll start with Greenidge versus McDonough, docket number 20-7820, argued November 30th, 2023, via video conference, and it was argued before Judges Greenberg, Toth, and Jaquith. Ken Carpenter argued on behalf of the appellant, and Matt Showalter argued for the government. Greenidge is actually an EJIA case that was remanded by the Federal Circuit pursuant to the Secretary's unilateral motion for vacator and remand of Judge Toth's single-judge decision denying EJIA. And there are a lot of reasons why I like this case, the first being that a cat made an appearance in the middle of a pretty dense discussion of what it means for the court to say that it didn't have jurisdiction over something.
There is EJIA jurisdiction because our order stipulates there are further agency action required with our dismissal.
What do you make of 7261?
So that was fun.
Whose cat?
Unclear, but I will tell you that if that happened in the middle of an argument that I was doing, it would definitely throw me off. But it did not seem to throw Matt Showalter off, who was arguing when Counselor Felix J. Catt made his guest appearance.
You think it was a judicial cat? You don't think it wasn't his cat?
I don't know. I couldn't really tell. It might have been his cat just because he handled it so well that he seemed like, I would have to duck out of the argument for a full hour to recover if that happened.
We're going to have to dig into this. This is an important issue to resolve.
So the background here is a little complex, as you probably gathered from the first sentence about the case. And so let's walk through it. In May 2020, the RO denied Mr. Greenidge's request to revise a prior rating based on Q. Then 5 months later, before the claimant filed a notice of disagreement or anything, the board issued a decision denying revision based on Q. So there wasn't an appeal to the board, and the board just issued a decision. It's unclear to me how and why that happened. I'd imagine it probably has something to do with the transition into AMA because of the timing. May 2020 was the date of the RO's decision. Mr. Greenidge appealed the board's decision pro se, and attorney Michael Just got into the case through the consortium and was able to get the board's decision vacated, arguing that because Mr. Greenidge did not file a notice of disagreement prior to the board's decision, the board lacked jurisdiction to issue any decision on the queue. And I think that's right. You have to have an appeal to get to the board. That's in the board's jurisdictional statute, 38 U.S.C. 7104. The Veterans Court, in a single judge decision by Judge Toth, also agreed. The court held that the board did not have jurisdiction to issue the October 2020 decision, and so it vacated the board's decision. But it also said, if the board doesn't have jurisdiction, then neither do we. And this is where things get interesting. The court vacated and dismissed rather than vacated and remanded. Usually, when we identify a board error to the court will vacate the board's decision and remand the matter for a new decision. But here, the court just vacated and then dismissed the appeal. There was nothing to remand. Then, when Mr. Just filed an EJIA application, the court said that since we didn't have jurisdiction over the merit, we don't have jurisdiction over and can't award EJIA. So don't have jurisdiction over EJIA, can't award it. And it relied on this Federal Circuit case called Burkhart to reach that conclusion. Burkhart was about whether the term jurisdiction in the EJIA statute means that the court had to have actual jurisdiction over the appeal or only just potential jurisdiction. The Federal Circuit held that the term means actual jurisdiction, and since the Veterans Court had said in that case that it did not have jurisdiction over the appeal, the Veterans Court was also without authority to order EJIA. Importantly, though, there never was any challenge in Burkhart to the Veterans Court's conclusion that it lacked jurisdiction over the merits of the appeal. And the Federal Circuit kind of emphasized that in a footnote. So back to Greenidge. We just made a little Burkhart detour. Now we're back to Greenidge. Mr. Greenidge, with the help of Ken Carpenter, appealed the Veterans Court's decision up to the Federal Circuit. And the Department of Justice, who represents the secretary at the Federal Circuit, they filed a motion for remand saying that the Veterans Court forgot to address this other Federal Circuit case, Halperin. You following me so far?
Dear God.
All right, well, now we're going to take a Halperin detour.
That's so not like a cat noise. That's the car veering off the road noise.
Yeah. In Halperin, the Federal Circuit held that because the Veterans Court, as the superior tribunal to the board, always has jurisdiction over the board's determination as to its own jurisdiction, the Veterans Court, of course, also had jurisdiction to award EJA. So that's Halperin. Now back to Greenidge. Make that sharp left back to Greenidge. We're back in the Veterans Court on remand from the Federal.
Sorry. I was a little late on my left turn. Okay, I'm back.
We're back in the Veterans Court on remand from the Federal Circuit based on the Department of Justice's unilateral motion for remand. And the question is, which controls here? Burkhart or Halperin? Okay, this is, now you're going to kill me, Amy. Before we can get there.
Help! Help!
We need to answer a preliminary question.
Of course you do.
Did the Veterans Court really have jurisdiction over the merits appeal here? Remember, Judge Toth said no based on Burkhart. I think the answer is yes. And I think at least Judge Toth and Judge Jaquith agree. But both judges seem to agree that jurisdiction means the court's authority to hear a matter. And of course, the court has the authority to review the lower tribunal's exercise of jurisdiction. That's like black letter law. Here's how Judge Jaquith put it.
When we're talking jurisdiction, we're talking 7252, the authority to hear the case.
And here's Judge Toth kind of expanding on that notion.
Maybe it's easier to think about when you think of like a lack of jurisdiction, right? Now, a lack of jurisdiction means the court has no legal authority to do anything, right? And so if you look at the original memdeck, we basically got a joint motion to vacate a decision for lack of jurisdiction, which we vacated, right? And then because of the case law, you know, the practice was we dismissed it, right? If we truly lack jurisdiction, the VA could have ignored our order. It would be ultra vires. It is no legal effect. That's what lack of jurisdiction means. Like what Judge Jaquith meant, if somebody tries to appeal a criminal conviction in our court, that's an example of having no jurisdiction.
What Toth is referring to here as the case law includes this Veterans Court case called Braun. Ready? Another detour. Braun was decided in 2016 after Halperin. So remember, Halperin said, of course you have jurisdiction, Veterans Court, to review the board's determination of its own jurisdiction. And then a few years after that, Braun comes in and says that when the board issues a decision without jurisdiction, then the CAVC, the Veterans Court, lacks jurisdiction and the correct remedy is dismissal and vacator and not vacator and remand. So basically what Judge Toth did in the single judge decision here. But Judge Toth explains that if that were really true and the Veterans Court didn't have jurisdiction, then they'd not even have the power to vacate the board's decision. They'd have to just dismiss the appeal.
If I were the secretary, I mean, if you wanted to be bold, right, what you should do when we dismiss a case for lack of jurisdiction is simply do nothing. Because honestly, our admission that we lack jurisdiction means anything we technically said would be ultra vires about the impropriety, any procedural errors we pointed out, any lack of notice, any of that. It would just be a nullity. I mean, that's what lack of jurisdiction means.
And Judge Toth seems to understand that this is fundamentally at odds with even Section 7261, the statute defining the court's authority.
you know, basically we have the scope of our authority includes the authority to set aside board decisions that are in excess of statutory jurisdiction. I think it's
correct
that if our jurisdiction really were what Braun says, that would be impossible, right? We would, yes. If our jurisdiction were absolutely coterminous with the board's, we would not be able to set aside, because that's an act of jurisdiction, setting aside a thing. So obviously we've got some case law that seems to be in stark conflict with Halpern. The original, I mean, when I heard this case as a single judge, I mean, I'm bound by our case law, so I didn't give it too much thought. But now we're here, and the Federal Circuit's asked us to kind of discuss. So should we start overruling things? I mean, what should we do?
Right. I say, I'm sorry. You know what? This jurisdictional stuff makes my head hurt so much. Like I'm running for some meds right now, because it's almost, doesn't this stuff feel like to you, like this is like CAVC meets the metaverse, you know, like we have jurisdiction. We can do this. We don't have jurisdiction. If we did have jurisdiction, we could do this, but we don't have it. So we can't do this.
That's actually a really good point. And the judges get into this a lot here, that the case law from the Veterans Court and other courts like throughout the country until very recently has made a real mess of this term jurisdiction. And it's really way more simple than that. So remember at the top of this discussion when I said that I like this case for a lot of reasons? Well, one reason is because it's like another part of the CAVC's understanding of the word jurisdiction era. And this is what I mean. We have Veterans Court case law from not even that long ago, like 8 years ago, saying that its own jurisdiction is derivative of the board's. So if the board doesn't have jurisdiction, neither does it. And that's probably wrong. We know that from Halpern, which was actually decided 14 years prior to Braun. We know that from 38 USC 7261A3C, which has been around since way before Braun, and says that the court can set aside a board decision made in excess of statutory jurisdiction. And we know it from the Supreme Court, which over the last couple of decades has been trying to make it very clear that jurisdiction refers to the court's authority to hear the case at all. And so, Amy, you know, Judge Jaquith also kind of had the same concerns that you do, is that, you know, this jurisdictional thing stuff can get really, really confusing, and it really doesn't have to be. Here he is responding to the secretary's argument that a court's jurisdiction is tied to the kind of relief it can order.
It is just as simple as we've been talking about. Board decision affecting benefits equals we have appellate jurisdiction. That's what Halpern found, and that's what the Supreme Court has suggested is the case in Scarborough. And aren't we engaging in the kind of expansive, amorphous talk about jurisdiction that the Supreme Court has decried in a series of cases, Condrick, Arbaugh, Union Pacific, Wilkins, most recently, Judge Toth chronicled in our Hall decision. And we can't see the forest for the trees. We're running from tree to tree.
Yeah. Judge Jaquith is with you, Amy, saying, stop running from tree to tree.
Yeah. Is it an all or nothing? You either have jurisdiction or you don't. And then what's the determining factor there? That's what's confusing to me still.
I think, and what Judge Jaquith is saying here, and what I think Judge Toth was talking about a lot during this argument, is that it's all or nothing. And the determinative factor is whether you have a board decision that's in an adverse party. I guess adverse party would be more like standing. But if there's a board decision affecting benefits, then the court has jurisdiction.
Even if the board did not have jurisdiction to issue that decision.
Right, because by taking jurisdiction and issuing the decision, the board is necessarily finding that it did have jurisdiction.
It did have, right.
And the court can always review that.
Right.
It's really that simple.
So the court always has jurisdiction under the statute. Right? Because it has jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction.
Right. I mean, of course, the exception would be like a remand order, because that's not a final decision. But anytime the board takes jurisdiction and issues a final decision affecting benefits, this court has the authority to review the board, at least the board's determination that it has jurisdiction.
Even if the board ultimately did not have jurisdiction to do what it did.
Right, right. And so the opposite must also be true, right? That anytime the board says, we don't have jurisdiction, the court has the ability to review that too. Just has to be in a final decision of the board, which can sometimes get tricky. We've been waiting about 2 years now for the decision in a case called Stiles that kind of plays with this idea.
Sorry, that's almost an easier case where the board says we don't have jurisdiction and then the court reviews that mm-hmm. final decision and says, oh no, yes, you do. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you're right, you don't. Mm-hmm. But when the board just takes the case, issues a decision lacking jurisdiction, and then the court has to say, no, you don't have jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. This bus has just gone off the cliff.
Yeah, well, I think hopefully the decision here, the panel decision here in Greenwich is going to help clear some things up. This Hall case that Judge Jaquith just referred to is another recent Veterans Court case that cleared up, I think, a bit what jurisdiction means. And that one was about the board's jurisdiction and whether it's tied to the specific VA form that the veteran used to file an appeal to the board. The answer in that case was no, because Congress didn't at the time, and I think still doesn't, tie the board's authority to even hear an appeal to the specific form used. As I mentioned at the top, 7104 is the board's jurisdictional statute. That's the statute that lays out the board's jurisdiction. And that doesn't say anything about a form. It just says you have to have a decision affecting benefits and an appeal. It doesn't say what form the appeal has to be in. So then any form requirement can't be jurisdictional. And I think that that's true even now that Congress has codified the VA form requirement into 7105, because 7105 is just a process statute. It's not the jurisdictional statute. I guess we'll have to wait to find out if I'm right on that. But the point is that Hall is another good case that starts to really lay some bright lines about what is jurisdictional, what's not. So in this case, you know, I think they'll actually say that the Veterans Court did have jurisdiction over the merits of the appeal. In essence, whether the board had jurisdiction to issue the decision it did is something that the court always can review, what we discussed, Amy. But the question in my head kind of remains whether they can do that without going en banc. Because remember, we have post-Halperin case law in Braun saying that the court doesn't have jurisdiction. And it's not like the Veterans Court issued Braun and then the Federal Circuit issued Halperin, so Halperin abrogated Braun or overruled Braun. Braun came after Halperin, so I don't know what they do there. I really don't. I guess stay tuned to see if there's an en banc order coming soon.
And they haven't done that yet. They haven't issued. No. Okay.
No. This case also has a couple side issues that I think are worth mentioning. The first is that VA doesn't really seem to have any coordinated litigation strategy between the Federal Circuit and the Veterans Court. Remember how this is a case that's on remand from the Federal Circuit, where VA filed a unilateral motion for remand for the court to discuss Halperin. You know, that seems to indicate that the VA thinks Halperin controls here, right? Like, why else would you remand it or ask the court, the Federal Circuit, to remand it? But then once we get back to the Veterans Court, the secretary shows up to court and says it doesn't control.
May it please the court. The court should again dismiss appellant's EJIA application for lack of jurisdiction because the Federal Circuit's narrow holding in Halperin can be distinguished from this case for two reasons.
That's Matt Showalter, by the way, whose argument I totally disagree with, but whose style I thought was great, especially when he was so rudely interrupted by the cat. He's another one that could have been a public speaker in a prior life. But, you know, given the context, his arguments raised some big questions for Judge Toth.
I want to ask about something I normally never would, but I think which is about the remand order from the Federal Circuit, right? And I know, you know, you didn't draft it, but why? I mean, it's the oddest thing where you're now defending my decision to me after you've requested me to reconsider my own decision in light of their, why not just keep it up at the Federal Circuit? Why not ask them to sort out their own precedent? Why ask us to do this?
And perhaps the best answer to this question actually came from Ken Carpenter in the rebuttal.
the court granted that motion. And I believe that the reason that they granted that motion, in all candor, Your Honor, is that you simply did not address Halperin. And therefore, that put the secretary in the position of being in a non-defensible position that Halperin didn't apply. And so the secretary could write a brief to the court saying that you made an error and it should go back to discuss Halperin. They decided that the path of least resistance was to move to vacate the appeal and return it for consideration.
And if that's the case, then it's really odd that the secretary would then argue before the Veterans Court that no, in fact, Halperin doesn't apply. So I'm not really clear on what's going on here. But I it kind of begs the question of, is this how they operate in other agencies? I mean, if you get an order from like the FCC, if you're a big media corporation, you get some sort of order from the FCC, and then I don't know if you go to district court or appellate court, but either way, I can't believe that there wouldn't be some sort of coordination with the agency in those cases. I don't know. We'll see. The other kind of side issue in this case is more of a practice pointer, which is do not limit your oral argument preparation to the primary issue in your case, even when the court orders you to be prepared to discuss just that issue. Here, Ken filed a motion for clarification when the case came back down from the Federal Circuit, and the court ordered the parties to be prepared to discuss Burkhart and Halperin. But questions came up about a totally different issue, prevailing party status. And though Ken was able to touch on it in rebuttal, I'm sure it was a surprise given the court's order. And boy, I hate oral argument surprises. So I'm going to remember this case next time I'm preparing for an oral argument. So that's Greenidge. Stay tuned.
Angry, angry kitty. Oh my God. All right, the next case we're going to talk about is Spiner v. McDonough, docket number 22-2636. This case was argued also via video conference on December 12th, 2023, before Chief Judge Bartley, Judge Greenberg, and Judge Jaquith. Justin Pollard of Bergman & Moore argued for Mr. Spiner, and Brian Carey argued for the secretary. And this is another AMA case that highlights just how amazingly well this new system is working and how great it is for veterans.
I sense a little sarcasm there.
There's a little bit of snark happening because this case involves everybody's favorite AMA statute, 7113. And there's a little bit of a complex background to this case. So I'll try to make this as brief and painless as possible. This appeal, Mr. Spiner's appeal, arises from a claim for service connection for head and neck cancer that he had filed due to the contaminated water at Camp Lejeune. VA denied that claim in 2015. He appealed that decision and in 2018 opted into the ramp. Also in 2018, he submitted a formal application 21-526EZ for service connection for esophageal cancer, and then received a letter from VA saying that they rejected that application, saying that he's already got an appeal pending. Remember, his appeal is for head and neck cancer. Shortly after that letter, the RO then denies service connection for head and neck cancer, specifically for the diagnosis of tonsil cancer. And he appeals that decision directly to the board. He chooses the hearing docket with the evidence submission option. The RO then, apparently forgetting that it had rejected his claim, saying that he already had an appeal pending, they issue a separate decision that denies service connection for the esophageal cancer. He submits a supplemental claim to appeal that decision, and the RO denies it again.
I gotta say, this is a real problem with AMA because the statute is clear. You cannot be in two places at once in AMA. You cannot have a supplemental claim pending for the same disability while you're already at the board. But the ROs do not seem to know this. I don't know if there's like a problem with the electronic record system or case tracking or something that's not showing up. But it's causing a lot of confusion because people will file a supplemental claim with new evidence And then the board will say, well, we can't review that because it was submitted after the rating decision that's on appeal. And something really needs to be done about this.
Yep, I agree 100%.
I haven't quite worked out what to do about it, but...
Well, here's one thing that needs to be done about it. If all the changes that were made in the AMA were procedural, these are procedural rules, and the AMA did not get rid of all prior substantive law. And so here, where a veteran files a claim for service connection for head and neck cancer, it should encompass all relevant diagnoses. And they started slicing and dicing here, where they denied service connection for, claimed as head and neck cancer, but they denied it for tonsil cancer. And then they treated his claim for esophageal cancer, which he was thinking it's part of the head and neck cancer. He was thinking of that as the same. They treated that as a totally separate claim. So they're treating separate diagnoses as separate claims. That's one problem. The second problem here that the RO recognized, hey, you've got a broad claim. You've got a broad appeal for head and neck cancer pending. So we're not going to accept this claim for esophageal cancer. And then they went and, this is, again, left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. They went and they issued a decision denying service connection for esophageal cancer. And at this stage, I don't know if that decision, I think there's some mention of where it's at in the processing, if it's been continuously appealed, but there's no reason for these two separate diagnoses to be running on two separate tracks. Mm-hmm. And so while, the supplemental claim conundrum continues to cause some confusion, but also the raters and the adjudicators who are treating separate diagnoses as separate claims when they're coming in around the same time, that needs to be straightened out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine if they're going to grant them and then assign the correct effective date, but that's not what's happening. They're just denying it and confusing the record.
Right. All right. So here, to add to the confusion of this case, the board then scheduled and rescheduled the hearing several times. There were several notice letters telling him about these hearings that were then, it wasn't clear if he actually got the notice letters. It wasn't clear why they were being rescheduled, but the notice letter said that he could submit evidence either at the hearing or within 90 days after the hearing. All the notice letters provided that information. So finally, he's got this hearing scheduled for October 2021. That's the hearing that's going to happen. In September 2021, in advance of the October hearing, he submits hundreds and hundreds of pages of medical records. VA acknowledges in writing that it received these documents, and they say that they were added to his file and were available for future interactions with VA. Future interactions, I'm doing air quotes as I'm saying that. So that's how they've acknowledged these records. They're available for future interactions with VA. At the October hearing, the veterans law judge acknowledged the new evidence and told Mr. Spiner's VSO representative that the evidence would need to be resubmitted in the next 90 days in order to be considered. The veteran did not resubmit the evidence, as he was told, and the board denied service connection without considering those records, stating that it lacked the legal authority to do so. Why? Because 7113 is a statutory license for the board to put its head in the sand. Here's Mr. Pollard's opening statement.
The board erred in failing to accept appellant's evidence at the October 2021 board hearing because under 38 U.S.C. section 7113B, a claimant is afforded the right to submit evidence at a board hearing. The term submit is not defined in the statute, and therefore the common definition is applied. And that dictionary definition of the word submit means to propose or refer to another for review. Here, appellant sent documents to VA in preparation for the hearing 1 week prior for review and discussion of that evidence at the hearing.
So because that evidence was submitted to the board in preparation for the hearing for discussion at the hearing and was indeed discussed, albeit loosely, not really in depth, it was mentioned at the hearing. The appellant argued that the board should have considered that evidence to have been submitted at the hearing. Unfortunately, Mr. Paolo didn't really get to dig into this argument, which I thought was a solid argument, because of the confusion about what type of hearing the veteran actually had. Was it a video conference hearing, which would be one where the veteran and the representative are there at the regional office and the VLJ is appearing via video? Or was it virtual with, you know, that, and that would have like all the parties appearing virtually? Chief Judge Bartley made the point that if the veteran had a virtual hearing, he would not have been able to submit evidence at that hearing, which is, that's one of the two options that are legally available to him to submit evidence.
The regulation 20.203, you know, appeals with request for a board hearing talk about submitting evidence and when you can submit that. But really, C only covers the situation where the appellant does not appear for a hearing and then says, and the hearing is not rescheduled. Here, it doesn't seem like he meets the requirement that he did not appear. So it's almost like there's no regulation to cover this circumstance.
Later in the argument, Chief Judge Bartley pressed the Secretary's counsel on the type of hearing Mr. Spiner had. Was it telehearing, you know, virtual or video conference?
If he had a teleconference hearing, and according to the notice letter, as I've indicated, that meant that he was off-site, would he have had access to both of those opportunities?
Your Honor, if a veteran participates totally virtually, whether via telehearing or a video telehearing, there obviously isn't the same opportunity to submit evidence physically in the form of, you know, documents, either at the regional office or at the board headquarters.
But so your answer is no, he did not have the opportunity, both opportunities to submit evidence.
And that was an excellent point and remains an excellent point. And the statute says you can submit evidence at the hearing or within 90 days after the hearing. But if you have a virtual hearing, how can you submit evidence at the hearing? It's an interesting question. Unfortunately, I don't really know if the court's going to answer it in this decision, because at the end of the oral argument, Chief Judge Bartley ordered the Secretary's counsel to provide information on the type of hearing that Mr. Spiner had, and as it turns out, Mr. Spiner was there at the regional office. The veterans law judge was video conferenced in, and here's the catch here, kind of, maybe. Yeah, the representative was the person who appeared virtually. So I'm not really sure how or even if the court will address this in the decision, since the actual situation differs from the premise of the argument, which was we had a virtual hearing, so we could not submit evidence at the virtual hearing. All right, given the procedural confusion that dominated the appellant's portion of the oral argument, I'm not going to spend too much time there in terms of bites. But what I found really quite insightful about this argument was the Secretary's position and how it shed light on VA's ongoing approach to 38 U.S.C. 7113, everyone's favorite statute.
Section 7113B of the AMA provides very clear limitations to the manner and time frame in which a veteran may submit evidence for board review. And the court should reject appellant's interpretation of the provision, which would require the board to review evidence submitted prior to the board hearing, which would otherwise be unreviewable, merely because that evidence was then noted at the hearing, as that interpretation would be inconsistent with the language, purpose, and structure of the AMA, and it would also render that statutory provision meaningless as a practical matter. So first and foremost, within Section 7113 is the phrase shall be limited. And as this court found in Cook, that language does not provide the board with any discretion to review evidence outside of that that prescribed window.
This is and has been VA's winning argument based on the plain language of the statute 7113, regardless of how inefficient or crazy strict adherence to that language may be. Here's VA's other winning argument, that the point of the AMA was to fix a broken system by limiting a veteran's ability to submit evidence.
And again, the purpose was to streamline the broken legacy system, which was broken in part because of the frequent and unlimited submission of evidence. And in doing so, Congress created the system that that deliberately served to limit the evidentiary record before the board, while still providing the option of, you know, different review options to include the supplemental claim, which provides for review of the entire record, as well as includes the duty to assist. And then, of course, if a veteran files a supplemental claim after the board decision, it can protect the earliest possible effective date.
Which brings us to the third point we've heard repeatedly from VA, and which Amy and I were discussing at the top of this segment. You know, when in doubt, when all else fails, file a supplemental claim. This is the solution to every problem you're going to have in your, you know, VA process. Just, you know, file a supplemental claim. And if at all possible, we need to start turning the word supplemental claim into a drinking game.
Yeah, here's the problem with that. This guy waited how long to get up to the board? And maybe this guy was an advance on, had an advance on docket motion that was granted. But people are now waiting like 3 years just sitting at the board waiting for a decision. So VA's answer to just file a supplemental claim just kind of ignores that you're now talking like 4 years later that these people have just been waiting for an answer, not knowing, or in the examples that we were talking about where people submit supplemental claims with new evidence, under the mistaken impression that the board will consider this new evidence that they submitted, and find out 4 years later, no, by the way, we're denying your claim. You can file a supplemental claim because you submitted some evidence that we can't review, but we're not going to tell you what that evidence was. You just kind of have to figure it out. And it's just not really very claimant friendly.
No, and they're forfeiting a retroactive award with it. Whether they're actually doing that or not, you know, that is what's happening. You know, you file a supplemental claim and the RO is going to assign the effective date as of the date that they received the supplemental claim. And then you're going to have to appeal for the appropriate effective date.
And what about these cases where the veteran did submit several supplemental claims in the 4 years she was waiting at the board? Is the RO going to say, no, we can't consider any of this evidence because we already did it, so it's not new?
Good question.
And then the board will say, well, it's, you know, the RO did consider it last time you submitted a supplemental claim while you were waiting up here for 4 years, so it's not new. That's going to be the next battlefield, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So Judge Jaquith wrapped up this portion of the oral argument by questioning the efficiency in forcing appellants to resubmit evidence that's already in the record.
Why wouldn't, in this circumstance, a board member say, I have 800 pages of evidence, he sort of does say that, was submitted a week ago. If you want me to consider it, instead of saying you have to resubmit it, why doesn't he just ask, do you want to resubmit that evidence? Yes, it's resubmitted. Does it really add something to the system to require a second upload of the same 800 pages?
One thing that I've noticed about Judge Jaquith is he thinks about these pretty difficult legal questions by really taking a step back and thinking about the bigger picture and, like, practically, what are we saying here? I find that refreshing.
I do too. I like his approach to the practical reality of the situation. Like, you know, really, do you really want someone to resubmit? I mean, where's the utility in resubmitting 800 pages of medical records so that you now have 1600 pages of medical records in the file? Is that really, really necessary? And this is why I said at the beginning that 7113 is the statute that gives the board the license to stick its head in the sand. They're aware of this evidence. They know that it's there. There's, you know, there is no reason whatsoever in a situation like this where they're saying, I'm looking at this, I see this evidence is there, yet I'm not going to consider it unless you run around the theater three times, you know, spit over your shoulder, throw salt up in the air, and resubmit the 800 pages all over again. Mm-hmm. What is the utility in that? And I do appreciate I don't think, Judge Jaquith's background is not representing veterans. He does not have practical hands-on experience as an advocate in this area, but he seems really in tuned to the realities of practice. And just I totally agree with you that, I appreciate just the very commonsensical approach to what VA is asking them to do and how they're being asked to interpret these statutes.
The other thing about 7113, and you and I have talked about this both on this podcast and at our NOVA conference presentations, is that I don't think it's a jurisdictional rule. It's true that it has that mandatory language, shall be limited. But it, again, 7113 is a procedural rule. It's not 7104 that sets forth the board's jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
So that means it can be waived or forfeited. Now, how does the board go about waiving that rule is a different question that I assume we will be getting into pretty soon here. We were supposed to get into it in one of my firm's cases, Corot, but it ended up remanding on a different basis via joint motion for remand before the oral argument. But
of course,
we've got to we've got to figure this out. 7113 is a mandatory rule, sure, but mandatory rules are not necessarily jurisdictional and can be bent in the right circumstances. So I think we need to start really exploring like what circumstances those are.
It's procedural. It is purely procedural. It's a processing rule. It doesn't, you're absolutely right. It's not jurisdictional and it shouldn't be treated as such. Mm-hmm. And the ignoring evidence when you see it right there and just saying that you can't, my hands are tied, go back to the end of the line, file a supplemental claim, or just, resubmit the evidence. In a case like this, it's just completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's also, when we're talking about 7113 issues, I also think that there may be some room for constructive possession. Aviles Rivera made clear that constructive possession doesn't apply in a period where an evidentiary window wasn't open, but we have not yet fully explored if and to what extent constructive possession does apply during evidentiary windows. After looking at the facts, I'm not sure that there's a good case here for constructive possession because, as you mentioned, Amy, it seems like they just loosely discuss the records. But like, imagine in a board hearing, the board says, oh yeah, and I see here that you have esophageal cancer and your doctor says that it was caused by, your exposure to contaminated water. Very interesting. And then and the board decision says, oh, but I can't consider it because you didn't resubmit it. Like, I think that'd be a pretty strong case.
I agree with you there. And maybe, maybe not on the constructive possession angle, but, I don't have any clue about how the court's going to come out on this. The plain language of the statute that allows a claimant to submit evidence, either at the hearing or 90 days after, is pretty clear. And so the issue that was at least discussed at oral argument, how does that work when you have a virtual hearing that sort of eliminates, an appellant's, one of their two ways to submit evidence? How does that work? I think that needs to be addressed, particularly since the board is encouraging people to do virtual hearings. And saying that they can be scheduled a lot sooner. Mm-hmm. Maybe the court's going to remand on fair process grounds because of the confusing notice that acknowledged the evidence. Maybe I don't think that these three judges really want to affirm the board's decision. But at the same time, getting around the plain language of 7113 is, it can be tricky. But here's what I think in Amy's world. Here's what the court should do. I think the court should hold that where, as here in this case, a veteran submits evidence in advance of a hearing for purposes of being considered by the veterans law judge and discussed at the hearing, and the evidence is indeed discussed at the hearing, the board just can't just put its head in the sand and ignore that evidence just because it wasn't resubmitted after the hearing. The board must consider that evidence to have been submitted at the hearing by reference, and the board shouldn't waste time and energy and paper and trees and taxpayer dollars by requiring a claimant to resubmit 800 pages of medical records that it knows is already in the record. That's the law, according to Amy.
I would sign on to that.
That's the law, according to two Amys.
That's the law, according to Arguendo.
All right, SCOTUS cases to look out for. Rudisil was argued before the Supreme Court on November 8th, 2023, and this case deals with multiple periods of entitlement to education benefits.
Amy, why do you think the Supreme Court took this case?
I don't know.
I have a theory.
I don't know. Do you think it's because they, you know, I think sometimes they take veterans law cases because they can be, you know, they can issue unanimous decisions and make it look like it's a highly functioning court?
Maybe. I also think, you know, this is a case about educational benefits for veterans. There are lots and lots of veterans in this country. A lot of people go to the military because of the educational benefits. And, you know, I think since World War II, it's kind of been a point of pride that we take care of our veterans as they transition into civilian life by providing them with educational opportunities. So I think it's patriotic to resolve these issues. So I don't know that it was the legal issue or the statutory interpretation issue itself that attracted the justices. My completely speculative theory is that it has more to do with like the importance of the national question.
That's a good point. I think that makes a lot of sense. I also think that they can, if they can agree on a veteran's case unanimously, it makes the court look good. Mm-hmm. And there's not too many issues that are coming before the court where you can have a unified Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
I mean, that was, you know, Arellano, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the first case that the court issued that term. And I think part of the reason why was let's just show the country that we are unified and that we can come together to issue a unified decision.
Against veterans.
Okay, well, it doesn't have to be a good decision, but it's a unified decision.
True.
All right. The next case that is not necessarily a veterans law case, but is going to have a huge impact on veterans law is the Loper-Bright case. This is the case that is likely going to undo Chevron. And one thing that I noted during this argument was the number of times that the Kaiser case was mentioned and the creation of a new term called Kaiserize. There was talking about Kaiser all throughout this oral argument and talking about Kaiserizing doctrines. So that was interesting.
For our listeners who don't know, Kaiser is a Supreme Court decision from a few years ago that clarified the Auer doctrine of deferring to agencies in their interpretations of their own regulations. But it was a veterans law case, and it was about 3.156C, the regulation that says that when VA receives new and relevant service records, it'll reconsider a previously denied claim. So that said, Amy, I love this Kaiserize term so much. I was thinking, should we start like a merch line and have Kaiserize t-shirts?
Once we figure out exactly how the Supreme Court is going to treat Kaiserizing in the Loper-Bright case, if they're going to Kaiserize in Loper-Bright, if they're going to Kaiserize Chevron, then oh hell yeah, we need some t-shirts made.
I wouldn't be mad if they Kaiserize Chevron. Chevron, I mean, I think it's just clarifying that it has to actually be genuinely ambiguous. You can't just say, the court can't just throw his hands up and say, oh, there are two plausible readings of the statute. Well, then we're going to do what the agency says. I think they're going to go farther than that.
You think they're going to just get rid of Chevron altogether?
Maybe not altogether, there was a lot of discussion about how the Supreme Court doesn't really use Chevron much anymore anyway.
Right.
And so I think they're setting it up so that they're going to make clear to the lower courts that they shouldn't be using it very much either. So yeah. I don't think they're going to completely kill it. I mean, this is all speculation, obviously, but I think Chevron's going to be a vestige of the past pretty soon here.
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court has pretty clearly abandoned Chevron. They've issued these administrative agency decisions without any mention of Chevron whatsoever. And I think they're being asked to, and they may use Loper-Bright as an opportunity to just kill it once mm-hmm. and for all. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a good thing necessarily. I do think that's where we're headed.
We are fortunate in this area that we don't have to worry about different circuits coming up with different interpretations depending on
right.
where the veteran lives.
Mm-hmm.
So if they do kill Chevron, we're not going to suffer as much as attorneys who practice in other courts that are not Article I courts with exclusive jurisdiction over certain decisions.
Right. That's a good point. We know who will be making all of the decisions, and we'll know pretty quickly mm-hmm. how they're going to be interpreting Loper-Bright.
Yep.
That's all for this latest installment of Arguendo. See you next time. Arguendo is a production of CCK Law, produced by... Okay, so stop. So since I have mangled Gordon's last name multiple times, I'm going to say his first name and ask him to insert his last name. So here we go. Arguendo is a production of CCK Law, produced by Gordon
Lutzai,
Amy Kretkowski, and Amy Odom. Technical direction by Gordon
Lutzai.
Our theme music was scored by J. Raoul Brody. Only one cat was harmed in the production of this podcast, and we had absolutely nothing to do with that.